This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today we're going to begin our show with a seasonal favorite. The Medora Musical is underway in North Dakota's number one tourist attraction during the summer. And joining us, as he has before, Justin Fisk, the Marketing and Communications Director for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. Justin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Your musical opened in the middle of June. How did it go?
Well, it went really well. A little later than usual. But we're so grateful to have North Dakota's show open and running. And, man, the message of Theodore Roosevelt overcoming hardship to become the president we admire today, we could all use a little bit more of that right now.
Now, this is a smart restart event, right? Because of the COVID-19 pandemic and people's concern about social distancing and all that kind of thing. Can you explain what differences they might see when they go to the amphitheater this year?
Sure. So the biggest thing is that the show itself is very much like everyone would expect. So your favorite parts are in it: live horses on stage, Burning Hills singers, live band, fireworks at the end, and a big patriotic finale. Those parts of the show are all still there, but when you arrive, you'll see a few different things. You're going to see some floor markings like you're seeing in other places. You're going to see a little different entry process to just add a little more space between folks as they prepare to enter the theater. And when you get into the theater itself, we've basically taken a two and two approach, meaning two seats will be for sale, and then there's a gap of two seats. The difference, though, is that groups that want to book together can sit together, and we'll have space, two seats, placed between them and the next group. And really, we just try to apply that process of adding a little extra space between folks across the board. Then you're going to see some of the staff wearing gloves and masks, and unfortunately, this year, we're postponing the kids' number until 2021. So the kids are going to stay in the stands this year, and 2021 we'll be able to welcome them back on the stage of the Medora musical.
What is the usual total capacity of the amphitheater?
Our outdoor amphitheater usually seats just about 3,000, and we're operating at about 50% this year.
So are ticket prices the same? Has there had to be some adjustment there to make up for lost capacity?
Ticket prices have not changed. We do offer a number of different price ranges, so there's a good price for many folks wanting to see the show, and there's a lot of good specials, too, with our most popular being that every Wednesday and Sunday, kids 17 and under are free at the Medora Musical.
Wow. So what is this doing to revenue?
Well, without a doubt, like many others across the nation, we will have a revenue reduction this year. We're pretty grateful that many, many partners, from advertising to our production team and everything in between, have helped make adjustments to agreements and contracts. So that's going to help. But we're going to see far less income this year, and we'll probably end up maybe taking a small bridge loan to close the gap so that we can continue to grow into next year and beyond.
I remember when I spoke to you last summer, you talked a lot about the number of workers who come to Medora in the summer from overseas. Has that been affected?
It certainly has. We had to change our recruiting plan this year quite a bit. And so essentially it boils down to no international workers that were out of country were able to come to Medora and work this year. We were able to offer jobs to a number of additional folks based in the U.S. this year who normally wouldn't consider Medora, and so that was good. And we were still able to offer a place to work for some international workers who were already in the United States back in March. And so it's far fewer international workers in Medora this year, none from out of country, and more domestic workers. Overall, our staffing is down just somewhat.
Is there additional protection for the performers and Medora workers and concessionaires? What kinds of precautions are being taken for them since they're basically living together in many cases for the summer?
Absolutely. The main difference is that we are trying to keep additional space between the cast and the audience as much as possible. The front row of the Medora Musical Amphitheater is not open for sale. There isn't any greeting lines at the end of the show. And the cast doesn't have the kids number where we get to have kids come on stage most years and imagine themselves as Burning Hill singers, but that number doesn't happen this year. And those are the main protections. Basically, the cast, like the rest of us, is also then encouraged to be personally responsible. Wash your hands. When you're going out, use the personal protective equipment you're comfortable using. And there's been we're grateful to have had a number of testings in Billings County to help keep everybody as safe as possible while being able to have some semblance of normalcy this summer.
Have you had any COVID cases among your employees?
No active cases in Billings County right now, as reported by the state. Everyone's personal health information is their own, but to our knowledge, there's no TRMF employee and no cast member who has tested positive.
If a member of the cast does test positive, what happens?
Well, we have a plan in place that would follow all the appropriate guidelines. Essentially, it would mean that those deemed close contact by the state contact tracing team would follow those procedures and isolate for the recommended period of time. We would then approach it from, let's see what we can do with what we have here. And that really matches up with our overall perspective on the season. To be really caring for everyone involved and also take TR's words of advice to heart to do what we can with what we have where we are. And so to speak, the show must go on.
Well, Joe Wiegand is a part of the show. He portrays Theodore Roosevelt at Medora during the summer. He's pretty well known for that. Has he altered his routine for the current affairs?
Oh, we are so glad to have the world's most renowned TR repriser in Medora. Joe actually relocated himself to Medora this year. He's an historian and hopefully going to be writing a book soon about Theodore Roosevelt and based around his perspective as performing as the president for so long. His show is very much unchanged, but like all of us, fist bumps and elbow taps replaced many handshakes. But the show where Theodore Roosevelt comes to life, very much unchanged at the Old Town Hall Theater. Of course, a small change in seating and a reduction in capacity at that theater as well.
Well, the Medora musical was the creation of Harold and Shyla Schaefer. Shyla was an old musical performer herself. Does the show from year to year change a bit?
The Medora musical changes every year. We have a number of core pieces of the show that we try to incorporate all the time, but the music is new every year. There's always some new cast members, and the way that we tell the story, or which parts of the story of Theodore Roosevelt and the story of Medora, there's so many amazing characters to tell the story of in the Medora musical that every year is new. But people tell us they love the big patriotic finale. They love reenacting the charge during the Battle of San Juan Hill. And so pieces of the puzzle like that are always in the Medora musical as well. They're fan favorites.
Let's talk about some of the supporting businesses that take, you know, are part of the Medora experience, the hotels and restaurants. How has their business been altered by the pandemic?
Well, the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation operates a number of hotels and other businesses alongside some really great private partners and state and federal operators as well. And everyone is approaching it really similarly, trying to do the best they can, following good smart restart guidelines. So you're seeing plexiglass shield, you're seeing some reduced capacity and some spaces, some unique ways, like you walk into the Hidden Springs Java coffee shop and it's a small building. So they've implemented a walk-up window for folks to order outside, and there are other businesses doing creative things like that as well. Everyone is happy to have the summer going. It's good to have people back in town. And the good thing about Medora is from the very beginning, you've had people from all over converging on this little place in the Badlands. You had the Marquis de Morez, a French aristocrat. You had Theodore Roosevelt, a New Yorker. And you had people who just lived on the range, cowboys, cowhands, all intermingling and respecting one another's wishes and spaces, not without dust-ups, so to speak. But today it's very much the same. People from around the state, primarily right now, and some out-of-staters, respecting each other's wishes and getting to experience a little bit of the Badlands. And everyone in town is grateful for that and glad to have the business as well.
So most of your tourists right now are from the region?
Yeah, most of the information we're seeing is showing that people are driving in, like usual, but from a little closer to home. And we're seeing a lot of North Dakota plates. We're seeing a few out-of-state license plates as well from folks who are looking for a little escape that isn't into a major metropolitan area. And that's good for North Dakota. It's good for us. And as long as we can show them that we're doing things well, we're doing the necessary sanitizing and adding a little space between folks and getting some good fresh air for them, then they're happy.
Have you reduced your marketing expenses because of the pandemic and the reality that fewer people might be showing up?
What we did from a marketing perspective is kind of start from zero. What would we do given this new normal? And that term's been used a lot, but we basically said, okay, let's say, what will we do if we had to reduce our budget? And we did. We're working off a 50% budget, but a totally different strategy. And we've been grateful for partners helping us through additional trade agreements and additional contributions for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation as an in-kind contribution. And we really took a look at how to spread the word in a different means than what we have always done. And it's been a good practice for us. And coming out of this, we're going to be able to take advantage of some new things we've learned from a marketing side as well.
In years past, have Canadians been an important part of the group that shows up?
We love our Canadian friends, and they seem to really enjoy time in the National Park and on the Motahay Trail. We see a lot of Canadians play at Bully Pulpit Golf Course. The Medora Musical, though, skews much more American than those other attractions, given that it's a celebration of American patriotism. And so our Canadian friends tend to enjoy the outdoors, and there's more Americans who enjoy the Medora Musical.
And the border is still problematic.
That's true. We aren't as subject to that as some of our other, some of the other tourist attractions in the area and the state. But we do notice a drop at places like Bully Pulpit Golf Course, and we see it in other places as well.
How important is this summer season to Medora and that part of the state in terms of economic sustenance, if you will?
Well, the town of Medora only has between 100 and 130 full-time residents during any given time of the year. And so tourism is the economic driver of Billings County and Medora. Without tourism, it would be a very, very bad hit to revenue. But more than that, we feel like having a season, a chance for people to rejuvenate themselves, a chance to see a little bit of entertainment, that means more than just the revenue side. It can inspire the state that we can go on, we can figure this out and do it together. And Theodore Roosevelt came to Medora after his mother and wife died the same day in the same house, and he came to heal. And right now we're seeing a lot of that in Medora. We're seeing people come and enjoy a little bit of the outdoors, get a taste of their normal summer traditions together. And there's a renewed sense of gratitude for that opportunity. And I think all of us at the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation feel that's the greater value than operating one season from a revenue perspective.
Now, besides the golf courses and the restaurants and the musical, of course, you have other attractions there and a couple new ones this year.
Yeah, we try to do something a little bit new for families every year. This year just happens to be a big one. We've got a brand new little Bully Pulpit mini golf course, which the course we had was fun and part of the summer tradition, and really a throwback to Americana drive-up hotel-motel business of the 60s. But the new course that we have goes up into the Badlands. It brings the history of Medora and the area alive at each hole and takes you through story of the Medora musical, some stories of Native Americans, energy in the Badlands, Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and it even does a little bit to replicate the experience of Bully Pulpit Golf Course, the actual top 100 public course just south of town. And man, since we have opened the Little Bully Pulpit Mini Golf, families have been loving it. You actually cross the street and go up part of the big butte that everyone sees when they come into Medora, and it's been a wonderful addition to town.
Is there a zip line too?
We have also opened Manitou, the point-to-point zip line, as our second part of what is a larger project called Point-to-Point Park. And it's a zip line ride, so it's open to far more people of ages and sizes, and it only takes a few minutes to do. And you load at the bottom, and you go up almost to the same height as that big butte in Medora, and you zip down. It's a fun family attraction. And that and the Little Bully Pulpit are just the first part of Point-to-Point Park, which is a family attraction based on Theodore Roosevelt's favorite game, Point-to-Point, where he would get groups of kids together and sometimes dignitaries from visiting governments, spin them around, point them in a direction, and they were off to that point that they could see in the distance, and the only rule was, no matter what they came to, they could go over it, under it, or through it, but never around. And so we'll be telling that story throughout Point-to-Point Park and a modern twist for families to enjoy the Badlands.
Well, another attraction that's coming up, it's in the works, is the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. What can you tell us about the progress on funding, locating the library, and designing it?
Well, we're happy to assist the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library as much as possible. Our organization's been working closely with them in a lot of ways, as well as others. We're excited for that library to open. We believe that is probably going to open in 2025, based on what that group tells us. We believe that they're well on their way to hitting the funding mark of $100 million privately raised before the end of the year, which would activate a state investment in a $50 million endowment that would support operations of this world-class museum experience. And from what we have been able to see as a partner so far, and what you can see on their website, is a very, very cool concept. World-renowned design architects competing for the right to design this project, and a site that if you're in Medora and you're near the Burning Hills Amphitheater where the Medora musical plays, that you can see will be outstanding for the library. The site they're considering currently will allow folks to walk right into the Badlands. It's along the Mottehay Trail, and it would very much replicate the kind of experience that Theodore Roosevelt fell in love with when he came to Medora.
Justin Fisk is Marketing and Communications Director for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. Justin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Theodore Roosevelt didn't spend years in North Dakota, but his time in the western part of our state was formative. Tom Ezern is the writer and voice of our Plains Folk essays, and today he talks about the formative years of a native North Dakotan, author Louise Erdrich. He titled this piece, Winning on Points.
In the middle of Louise Erdrich's brilliant and haunting novel, The Night Watchman, her protagonist, if the book can be said to have one, Thomas Washushk, whose surname means muskrat, tries to explain things to a white guy, a math teacher and boxing coach. He puts matters in simple terms, works through misconceptions, and sums up, "I don't want to give up our scrap of home. I love my home." Not for the first time, we are told, he felt sorry for a white fellow. The fictional character of Thomas Washoshk is based upon Patrick Gurnow, Erdrich's grandfather, who was night watchman at a defense subcontracting plant on the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation and also tribal chairman. It was on his watch that the Turtle Mountain people faced the existential threat of termination, that is, the attempt by the United States Congress to terminate the Turtle Mountain Chippewa as a tribe. The struggle against termination is one historic theme in the book. Erdrich explains, "My grandfather, Patrick Gurnow, fought against termination as tribal chairman while working as a night watchman. He hardly slept, like my character, Thomas Washoshk." The other historic theme in the book is the companion assault on tribal sovereignty and culture known as relocation. That is, the program by which federal agents sought to break up Native families by luring young people away from the reservation into cities, where they were promised benefits. The plot line whereby one Native woman gone to Minneapolis comes to grief, but survives it, resonates with continuing stories about the disappearance and abuse of Native women. Let me insert here that Erdrich's novel is so fine and provocative, you may wish to read more historically, perhaps from a Native scholar, about the tragic policies of termination and relocation. In that case, I recommend the book by Donald Fixico, Termination and Relocation, Federal Indian Policy, 1945 to 1960. I won't summarize the novel. Read it yourself. Preferably, get it from your favorite independent bookstore. Let me offer a couple of observations by way of connection and comparison. Given the regional orientation of Plains folk, I want to observe a commonality between Erdrich's work and that of the great literary light of the settler society, Willa Cather. Both of them are at their best when they dwell in their home country, when they say, "I love my home." Night Watchman is inseparable from Turtle Mountain. Both writers, too, create memorable characters and pass the narrative voice around among them. Sometimes, too, an important female character is present but not speaking. I'm thinking of Erdrich's treatment of the powerful traditionalist Zanat. It is this appreciation and portrayal of female characters that most distinguishes Erdrich from the novelist who previously addressed relocation and its impacts, N. Scott Momaday in House Made of Dawn. A painful set piece in Erdrich's narrative is the boxing match, organized to raise money for the Turtle Mountain delegation to go to Washington and testify against termination. The antagonists are Wood Mountain, the Chippewa boxer who surfaces from the narrative as a quiet hero, and his nemesis, Joe Wobozinski. They go the distance. The fight gets ugly. And Wood Mountain, whose name carries historic freight tangled with Erdrich's ancestry that I have not yet unpacked, Wood Mountain wins by decision, on points. But both fighters are damaged, diminished, and scarred.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a conversation with the executive producer of the podcast and public radio show, Threshold. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. A federal judge has ordered the Dakota Access Pipeline to be shut down, pending an environmental review. Judge James Borsberg earlier ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to do a full environmental impact statement on the $3.8 billion pipeline. The Corps had done an environmental assessment. The ruling says the pipeline must be shut down and emptied of oil by August 5th. Senator Kevin Cramer says he expects the oil industry to appeal the order. Kramer says the judge's order is, quote, not good for the energy security or our national security.
I don't know if it's an intellectual exercise or if he's just finding himself not that popular at the country club, but this was a major decision that, if allowed to stand, would be devastating to North Dakota's oil industry, because, of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline provides access to markets that without it would be very difficult to reach.
Corn planting saw a sharp decline in North Dakota this year. Figures from the USDA showed 2.4 million acres of land were dedicated to corn, marking a decline of 31% when compared to 2019.
It's a result, I think, of our growers just being hit from all sides this year. Certainly with the impacts of COVID, the prices, ethanol being shuttered in many places, thereby reducing the demand. And so, yeah, it's been a tough year so far.
Brenda Elmer is executive director of the North Dakota Corn Growers Association. She says instead of planting corn, a number of growers are going with Prevent Plant as a way of cutting their losses. She says despite the challenges, there is growing optimism for renewed trade opportunities now that the USMCA trade agreement with Mexico and Canada has gone into effect.
North Dakota corn, as did corn nationally, pushed hard on that trade agreement in support of that. And we're hoping that will certainly help our outlook a little bit, too.
In speaking with the ethanol industry, Elmer says the groups are already saying they could use most of what's being produced this year and use it for production of the renewable fuel. And an Ada-based organization is being recognized for its innovative use of a sensory room to help people with autism. The Norman County Developmental Activity Center opened the room last fall. Executive Director Hillary Chisholm says it helps people who have difficulty processing stimulation they receive in everyday activities. She says data collected so far shows people who use the room are less likely to harm themselves because they're overstimulated. The organization recently won an award from the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The word threshold can signify a transition. Threshold is the title of a podcast and public radio series that reports on the most pressing environmental stories of our time. Season 3 focuses on the Arctic Wildlife National Refuge, the largest in the U.S., and what opening the refuge to oil drilling could mean economically, culturally, and environmentally. Amy Martin created and hosts the Peabody Award-winning show. She spoke with Ashley Thornburg about the four-part series airing Tuesdays in July on Prairie Public.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to focus season 3 on the impacts of potential oil drilling in the Arctic Wildlife National Refuge?
I have been interested in this issue all the way back from when I first heard about it, which I think I was in high school. Over the many years that it's been in and out of the media, I never really felt like I truly got to understand it in a very up close and personal way. So I wanted to go there and get a more in-depth look at the issue myself and bring that to my listeners. What does the question about drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge mean to people who live there? What does it mean if you're really familiar with this place, if it's not just some sort of exotic mystery fantasy land in the Arctic, but if it's maybe your home in a place that you actually are connected to? So that was kind of the motivation for digging into it.
Well, you mentioned that you've been interested in the area since high school, and within the podcast, there are references to years of reporting from the Arctic before you ever even made it to the wildlife refuge. Can you give us a sense of what it feels like to be in this place? There are no roads. This is millions and millions of acres of land, one town, and caribou, polar bears. What's it feel like?
It honestly feels like nothing else I've ever experienced. The refuge is huge, and I only got to be inside it in one part up on the northern coast, which is where drilling has been approved. But I got to be right on the southern side of it too, where I got a pretty good sense of what it's like on that side. It's majestic. It's like the size of the country of Austria, but with no roads. The sense of stepping into a place that is truly where wildlife gets to rule and do whatever it wants to do in its own natural ways is just so palpable. It's a place that I think anybody, you know, this issue has become really politically charged, but I think anybody in any place on the political spectrum spending time there, it circumvents all of those kinds of divides. And it just, I would be really surprised to find anybody who couldn't feel a connection to the wonder and just kind of the awe of a place that's so big and so wild and so harsh. You know, it's above the Arctic Circle. You have to be tough to survive there, whether you are a polar bear or one of the many, many birds that migrates in from thousands of miles away, or if you're a person, the many people who've lived there over the years, you know, indigenous people who've made their living off of the land there. So it's fascinating. It's wonderful. I'd love to go back and spend more time.
You mentioned that there was some potential for oil drilling on the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. How big of an area is the coastal plain in relation to the rest of the wildlife refuge?
In very loose terms, it's the entire coastal plain is like the northern third of the refuge. The part where drilling has been approved is a subset of that area. It's actually a little bit complicated describing how much land could be included in drilling, because the amount of land that's officially been allowed for drilling is about 2,000 acres. But the thing that makes it kind of complicated to visualize that is that those 2,000 acres do not have to be continuous. And so, you know, if or when drilling does move forward, it's probably going to happen in small, lots of different drill sites spread out over a significant area. Each one of the little places where the drilling equipment touches the ground gets counted towards that 2,000 acres, if that makes any sense. And so it's not like we're going to take 1 2,000 acre hole out of this chunk of land and designate it for drilling. It could be 10 acres there, 5 acres there, half an acre there, and all add up together to become 2,000.
Yeah, you make the comparison in the podcast of it being more like if Legos were strewn across the room and they could be sort of dotted everywhere, and altogether that might equal that amount. Why do they have it set up to be potentially small amounts that are not continuous? Does this potentially mitigate some of the risks associated with oil drilling? If you have a small area, perhaps it's a small containment for a spill?
No, I think it's more coming out of just the logistics and the realities of how oil is drilled in the Arctic, that there's going to be a place where the drill rigs are set up. And then, you know, most of the drilling is going to happen like horizontally. They go down and then they go, you know, across. That's a certain number of acres. It wouldn't be 2,000. But then, you know, you got to get the oil out of there. And this is one of the things that's really complicated about drilling in this area. As we mentioned, there's no roads. So they would need to build a pipeline from the refuge over to the Prudhoe Bay oil field, where it could connect up with the Trans-Alaska pipeline that goes all the way down to the Port of Valdez in the southern part of Alaska. And so wherever that pipeline has supports that meet the ground, each one of those supports gets counted toward that acreage. And then there's roads that have to be built, you know, internally for people to get around. So it's like all of those impacts together have to add up to 2,000 acres or less.
There are so many different facets of people who are impacted by oil drilling. I mean, you could almost do a whole season on just the economics, just the cultural implications, just the environmental implications, and realizing that it's a very complicated issue. Could you sort of paint the main highlights of the interests that you focus on here? Let's start with the environmental concerns. What are the main environmental concerns for saying why they shouldn't drill in the refuge?
Yeah, the people and organizations who are advocating, you know, against drilling raise questions like, why would we choose to open up new fields in one of the most remote parts of the United States, where the logistics of getting equipment in, getting the oil out, getting workers in and out. All of that has major environmental impacts on one of the wildest places left on the planet. So, you know, just the process itself has impacts. And then there's the possibility of a spill. There's the fact of trying to clean up a spill in the Arctic is something we don't know how to do yet. And if that spill drilling, the bulk of drilling would happen in the winter. And and that means that the sea ice is also frozen. So then you're talking about the only way to get a heavy equipment in would be flying things in, which is pretty complicated if you're talking about massive, you know, the kinds of equipment that you need. It's just, there are a lot of risks. And then there's also, you know, the impact on the wildlife itself, just from having a lot of equipment there, and people coming in and out. And there's also climate change concerns. You know, a lot of people are saying, why would we choose to open up new fields? There's already a whole lot of oil coming out of the fields that already exist. So there are other concerns, but that's kind of the highlights from that side of the picture.
What about from a cultural perspective? There are indigenous people who have called this area home for, I mean, upwards of 20,000 years.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is that there are at least two indigenous communities that have a very strong connection to this place. There's the Gwich'in, who are more of an interior tribe, and there's the Nupiat, who are up on the coast. And it is not a, you know, first of all, I want to just say that I am not Gwich'in or a Nupiat, and I don't want to try to speak for them. But what I learned from talking to people in those communities is that there's a real diversity of opinion, even among those groups. The Gwich'in are fairly united, I would say, against drilling. I did not meet one Gwich'in person who was in favor of drilling. But the Nupiat, there's people that are really wanting drilling, and there's people who really are not wanting drilling. And that feels important to mention, because sometimes the story gets painted that all Gwich'in are against it and all Nupiat are for it. That's not true. On the other hand, sometimes you hear people say, like, oh, all indigenous people are against drilling. That's also not true. It's a complicated picture. But one thing that I will say that it really came through is people of both of those tribes felt very strongly that, you know, that they have longstanding connection to that land and to that place. And I think that's something that maybe other Americans might not recognize, is that some Americans do call this place home, and that they still have rights to hunt and fish there, and that that's protecting those animals, I think, is important to everybody, even if they are pro-drilling.
How would you characterize the ability for their voices to be heard and counted into the matter of, do we explore drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge? Like you said, we're a fan of saying, oh, indigenous people, and not just this 540 some or more indigenous tribes, and we sort of reduce that down to one perspective. And like you said, just within this community, there are at least two voices. Have they had an easy time bringing their concerns in to be recognized, deciding what goes forward?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think that I can hear everybody I've talked to saying, no, they have not had an easy time. And I think that's people on both sides of this drilling debate would say that it's been really hard to get politicians, people who are leading the charge against or for drilling, to pay attention to them and to recognize that this is not just a decision that should be made by outsiders who either, you know, care about this place for the wilderness values or who see a chance to make a lot of money drilling for oil. I think that there's a sense from the indigenous people that I spoke with that sometimes in both communities that they are invisible, and that they sometimes people try to use them as pawns to speak for one side or the other, versus truly bringing in the local people as stakeholders and inviting them to have a meaningful and substantive impact on the outcome. And if there's one thing that can come out of this work of producing this series, I would hope that it would be more awareness of the need to include local people, and in this case, the local indigenous people in this kind of decision making.
We're visiting with Amy Martin. She is the founder and executive producer of the Threshold podcast and radio series. Season one focused on rewilding the American bison. Season two focused on a life in the Arctic across multiple countries in that area. And season three explores the And season three explores drilling in the Arctic Wildlife National Refuge. Season three airs Tuesdays on Prairie Public at 8 p.m. And Amy, you mentioned that there is a chance of more likely to be in favor of drilling for the Inupiaq people, and they're on the coast, versus the Gwich'in people who are more interior. And a lot of that, from what I could tell in the podcast, comes down to economics, and specifically talking about how oil money in the state of Alaska has allowed for there to be running water, building clinics, building roads, places where in a very harsh environment, these things can sort of make or break a community. I knew oil money was big in Alaska, but I was blown away when you said that 80 and sometimes 90% of the state budget comes from oil money. Can it be overstated how big of a role the economic impact of oil exploration in Alaska is?
No, I really don't think it can be overstated. And I think it's important to know that, you know, the state of Alaska has been really in dire straits economically long before the coronavirus pandemic because of declining oil production, primarily in Prudhoe Bay. You know, it was once the largest onshore oil field in the world, or one of them, I should say. And it's past its prime. It's going to be dried up fairly soon. And that what that has meant for the state of Alaska has been catastrophic. And a lot of people have said that they should be figuring out how to provide for their needs as a state in more diverse ways. But that's an argument I'll let Alaskans have. The at the end of the day, that has not yet happened, or if it is going to happen. And then add to that, you know, this complete shock in the oil markets due to the coronavirus pandemic. And there is enormous pressure on Alaska politicians to find money somewhere. The tricky thing about the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, though, is that if it were to go forward, you know, Alaska's not going to see any money from that for more than a decade. And so it's certainly not going to solve any of the short-term problems. But, you know, I think that for people that have longstanding sense that oil is the economy, those arguments kind of fall on deaf ears. It's just like, let's get some more oil going one way or the other. Is really the focus among the Alaska delegation.
Within the podcast, you speak with tribal leaders from the Gwich'in Nation and the Inupiaq Nation. You speak with oil field workers. You speak with Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. You are not an indigenous person. You're not an oil field worker. You're not a politician. Was it hard to get all of these people who have very different stakes in what happens here to talk to you?
It took some effort, as it always does. But you know, that's our job as journalists, as to keep asking and keep asking. I feel like I feel very, very grateful for everyone who shared their time with me. You know, I got a tiny little slice of time with Lisa Murkowski, but I'm grateful for it. She didn't have to say yes at all, and you know, same with everybody. I feel like for Indigenous people in particular, you know, talking to a white journalist who didn't grow up in their community, there's a long and kind of sad tradition of people coming in and taking stories and not giving people credit or kind of trivializing people, simplifying their lives. So I'm just so grateful that people took the risk to share their stories with me, and hopefully I didn't make some of those mistakes. And if I did, I hopefully will hear about that and learn from them. But no, there were some times it was hard. There were some people I wanted to talk to that I didn't get to talk to. But at the end of the day, I'm glad that I got to talk to everybody I did and just, you know, it's a risk. I would be a little nervous. Somebody comes knocking on my door with a microphone, and I'm really happy that everybody said yes who did.
I feel like so much of this story that you do hear in different forms of media is very much like it's us versus them and everybody's fighting and there is absolutely no middle ground or no ability to even consider the other person's perspective. And within the four-part series, you very much do explore this perspective and this perspective, but there's not fighting. There's not name calling. There's not, nobody can listen to anybody and everybody is dumb. And I interviewed the author of a book called I'm Right and You're an Idiot. And that it just explores this idea that if I think this and you don't, then everything that you think is stupid. Why do you think it is so important to do reporting like this?
Well, partly it's a personal thing of I'm just hungry myself for conversation and dialogue that is more rooted in our better selves and not our worst selves. And I think that we really, it's so disheartening to see ourselves, you know, reflected back in our worst nature, just shouting and name calling and just, you know, talking over each other. Everybody's worried about getting a point made instead of listening. And I think, I know from my own experience from talking to people on all sides of difficult issues that, I think there's a part of every person who really is open to that really is open to hearing from people that they might not expect to agree with. But I think that those sides of us are not reflected enough. We don't get to hear and see each other doing that. And so we start to believe that it isn't possible, that all humans are is selfish, and we're all much more interested in the sound of our own voices than we are in listening to others. And I just refuse to believe that. I think if that were the case, then I would want to just hang it up right now. And I think we're better than that. And I think that it's, it does my heart and mind good to try to be better than that and try to show people being better than that. And I also think if we're going to make any progress on any issue, whether, you know, name it, healthcare, racial justice, environmental issues, anything, we have to start from a place where we believe that it is possible that reason arguments and good faith attempts to understand each other can move the conversation forward. And maybe nobody's ever going to get 100% of everything that they want, but that progress is made when we take the risk to believe that the people on the other side of that table, that maybe there are opponents on an issue, but they don't have to be our enemies, and that we can move forward together in some way. And I think the most inspiring people in history are people who have operated from that position, and it's just essential to try to make space for that. And just, again, on a personal level, it's essential for me or I'm gonna go crazy. So trying to ward off insanity.
This is why I have a yoga practice. Amy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Threshold founder and executive producer Amy Martin with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg. Season 3 airs Tuesdays in July at 8 Central on Prairie Public's radio service. Dakota Datebook is next.
It's easy to voice what our values are.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
But living by them, that's another story.
There are things that we know are wrong, and we say, well, that's for someone else to deal with.
The contradictions of an American icon.
All men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator.
This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Hidden Brain, coming up tonight at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 6th. In the days before the internet and mass media, huge fairs provided entertainment and educational opportunities. The White City of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair attracted people from around the world.
The St. Louis World's Fair of 1904 was immortalized in Judy Garland's film Meet Me in St. Louis. And on this date, in 1905, the Lewis and Clark Centennial American Pacific Exposition and Oriental Fair was in full swing in Portland, Oregon. Located on the West Coast, the Lewis and Clark Exposition presented business opportunities of tremendous magnitude. North Dakota was anxious to participate. The state's exhibit was located in the Agricultural Building. People who knew nothing of the Great Plains would hopefully become familiar with the state and its products. An article in the Hope Pioneer detailed the effort that went into the North Dakota exhibit. The newspaper optimistically boasted that the Wyoming and Montana exhibits located directly across the hall could not draw as many spectators as North Dakota. Even Oregon, which took up fully half the building, could not compete, according to the Hope Pioneer. The centerpiece was Teddy Roosevelt's cabin. This drew a great deal of attention, and President Teddy Roosevelt sent an autographed portrait to hang on the cabin wall. Large glass grain jars displayed the grains produced in the state, and the display was called the most original as well as the most beautiful work in the building. The agricultural exhibit was augmented by prairie chickens and jackrabbits. Who could resist? The display of North Dakota pottery made from the clay near Dickinson surprised many spectators, and businessmen were anxious to get more information about the clay. There was an impressive flour exhibit from mills across the state, and with Asia beginning to open up, the mills hoped the exhibit would broaden their markets overseas. The railroads also helped boost the state. Since many people returning east after the fair would travel through North Dakota, the railroads offered stopover privileges, allowing passengers to spend time in North Dakota before continuing on their journey at no extra cost. That had folks asking about interesting places to do some sightseeing. Additional excitement was expected later in July when it was North Dakota Day at the fair. The paper said it was sure to, quote, attract the attention of every person on the grounds to North Dakota and her exhibit. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and we always remind you that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on Main Street, infectious disease researchers in the Department of Biomedical Sciences at UND are working on a vaccine for COVID-19. We'll discuss their work and the strategies that can help address pandemics with Dr. Nadeem Khan. And adapting to life during a pandemic has been a particular challenge for agencies that help senior citizens. We'll talk about it with Brian Errett, the director of Valley Senior Services. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.